Welcome to The Bounce Back, streaming on the WDKX Podcast Network. Listen conveniently on your WDKX mobile app and online at WDKX.com. Now here's your Bounce Back host, Adam McFadden.
Welcome to The Bounce Back. This is the ninth episode of The Bounce Back. I started this podcast to give an opportunity for our listeners to hear stories of people who have been through some things when life is lifing and came out of those things. So I'm going to allow you to introduce yourself to Rochester and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hey, Rochester, New York. My name is Mike Quell Powell. I'm a social worker, a drug and alcohol counselor, a mental health counselor. I'm the executive director of a grassroots nonprofit called the Reentry and Community Development Center on North Street. We work with people that's coming home from jail or prison. So I'm just happy to be on the show.
All right. So as many of my listeners know, they know that I went away for a little while, did what I would call some minor time, right? 4 months in a federal prison, and came back and hit the ground running, you know, was able to find employment and do some things just because of, I guess, my background, my education, and networking. But like you said, you have a reentry program. So what are some of those things that you tell people when they're coming home? Like, what is the best advice you could give to someone that's just coming back?
Yeah, so myself, I went away this a little time too. Did 6 years in New York State prison and came home and completed 3 years on parole. So what I tell the brothers and sisters that I'm working with now, and that's in reentry, one of the main things I'd be wanting them to know is that it's going to take a little while to get back on your feet. I think sometimes we set ourselves up with unrealistic expectations, mm-hmm. That when we come home that things is just going to be like how they was before, or it's going to be easy to get back on our feet. We've got to remember some time passed and it's not the same as when we went. So that's why I be trying to give people the heads up and let them know, take your time. It's going to take a little while before you get back on your feet.
What would you say you personally was the hardest thing about you bouncing back from when you came home?
Me, it was because I led a street life. Mm-hmm. So that's all I was used to from the age of like 13 or 14. I was in the streets. I come from Sayo Street, and I was a well-known drug dealer too. And I never worked. I never had no job. I dropped out of school in the ninth grade. So that the hardest thing for me was like learning how to live a totally different life without the streets. A lot of people expected me to go back to that. Right. But I had a different mindset. I wanted something different. I wanted to try something different. So living that type of life was the hardest thing for me because I had no clue.
So what would you say the biggest motivator for you to be in that mindset?
The biggest motivator for me is that I didn't want to go back. You know, a lot of people go to prison and then they return to prison within the first 3 years. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the times they go back to do a significant amount of time. I had just turned 21. And I was gone for 6 years, so I came home when I was 27. So I felt like I missed my whole 20s. So there was no way that I wanted to come back and do my whole 30s in there. You know what I'm saying?
Right,
so
right. My
biggest motivator was just staying free and trying to get back to my community, get back to my family in some capacity. And that was something that, and also my spirituality too.
I had
found like faith, and I promised God, like, if you let me come back from this one, I'm definitely going to do something different.
Yeah, I know for me, the toughest thing really was mine was so public, right? So I couldn't get away from it. I could not. And so I was lucky to have family and friends that, you know, really loved me and stood by me. But I lost a lot of people in the journey too. I ain't going to lie. And mm-hmm. And I'm happy to lose them because they really wasn't like that, you know, if they couldn't stand through it. So it's kind of one of those things where you remember the people who stood in the rain when they had the option to be dry, you know,
they stood
in the rain with you and went through the storm. And so the hardest thing is, you know, trying to escape that mistake, because I tell people all the time, a lot of us make mistakes, right? Some mm-hmm. of us get caught for them. Mm-hmm. Some of us don't.
Right.
And you know, some people don't let, they will never let you live that mistake down as if nothing else matters. So I think for me, that was like the hardest part of it. And then I would say facing my own children, because, you know, I was the breadwinner in my house. I got three daughters, and preparing them for what life would be without me for a little while. That was really, really tough.
Yeah, I can imagine how tough that that was, and I kind of went through it too in the public eye. I had a high profile shooting when I was 20 years old. That's what I went to prison for. But nobody didn't know me. So it was only high profile because of the incident, not because of who I was. But in 2020, I had been home for almost going on 10 years. And I had, it was over 10 years, but I had got elected to be on the police accountability board. And then once they announced who was all on the board, the mainstream media seen me on there.
And they dug up.
Yeah, yeah, they started digging up old bones.
Yeah.
So I went through that publicly for a long time. You know, I was kind of like the face of the police accountability board for a long time. And, you know, the community rallied behind me. So that's one of the things that I was proud of. But what I said, what I wasn't going to do is I wasn't going to let my incarceration, now it's been over 20 years, I'm not going to let it be a life sentence.
No, it can't.
So I didn't stop doing nothing I was going to do.
Right.
I just kept on doing what I was doing, and I was praying, and everything worked out.
Yeah, and I think for me, being an elected official, I had already gained some tough skin, you know, so I was used to people having an opinion about me anyway. So that part of it didn't bother me, but I think it bothered my children, to be honest with you, if anything. And that's the hard part for me, because you want to shield your kids from anything and everything, right? And so, you know, watching them go through that, but it made them stronger. I'm actually proud of the people that they became because of it, because it caused their bond to be stronger with each other, stronger with their mom, who now had to fill in for me while I was gone. And then when I came home, I came home to a better relationship than I had before I left. So there's a lot of positives that came out of what I would call being in the fire. Because sometimes you have to go through, you know, those trials and tribulations to come out a better person. And, you know, there were some things about me that definitely needed to be worked on that got worked on. So for me, I look at my situation like this. I went through something, right? But I had to go through that to become the father I am today. And I'm happy about that. I would not trade that experience for anybody. I don't have regrets other than hurting some folks, but I don't have regrets of the process of going through and becoming the man that it turned me into. So now I'm kind of like family first, family driven. And I've been concentrating on the development of my, you know, I got three children. One of my girls, she's an adult, but the other two are in college, and I just pour as much as I can into them.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So for you, what's next?
I just became a licensed master social worker. So I'm a mental health therapist. I'm trying to grow my grassroots nonprofit too. I want to expand. We are growing. And I just want to be a mental health therapist until I could be a clinical mental health therapist. And then, God willing, one day I'll probably have, I want to have a black-led mental health agency in the middle of some of our poorest neighborhoods, like on Hudson Avenue, on Joseph Avenue, you know. So that's one of my ultimate goals. But right now, I'm just trying to focus on still giving back to the community. I pride myself on the majority of the things I do now. I do it in the same neighborhood that I went to prison in, and I terrorized the neighborhood for a long time. So I pride myself on doing a lot of stuff on Sayo Street. That's my way of giving back.
So I heard you mention the mental health aspect. And it's funny because that was one of the things that helped me. I actually received counseling from a black therapist while I was going through my challenges. And I still receive counseling because I found it to be a great help just in general to be able to release some of the stuff or, you know, work out some thoughts or feelings, that kind of thing. And, you know, there was a time when there was a stigma in our community that people didn't really want to seek that because you got labeled something. But it's actually more normal to do that than to hold it in and then blow up on people, you know? And so I'm glad you brought that up. And I hope that people listening would seek out that help, maybe through you and your organization or someone else, But there definitely is a need for more people of color in that field, and our folks using that as a resource and an asset.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just talking about this on another platform not too long ago, is that the stigma surrounding mental health is kind of fading away a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You do have people now, black men and black women, that's actually asking for a therapist. They're asking to be seen by somebody. But like you said, when they finally do get somebody, 9 times out of 10, the person don't look like them. And not that, and that's not to say that a person that's white or a person that's not a person of color, that they can't be a good therapist. It's just saying that a person that's black, they see.
Or there's some cultural competencies that need to happen, because the way we relate, the way we talk, our diet, like all of that stuff, there has to be some general understanding of where we're coming from.
Right.
And we also have those, what I would call, historical traumas that we deal with. Have a police car drive behind you. You haven't done anything, but there's a trauma you feel.
I'm looking at that rearview mirror.
That's historical. That's something that I don't think that a white therapist could actually relate to, that a black therapist could. You know, and it's those types of things.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, you want to talk to somebody that look like you. So it's changing a little bit. I know I've said this before, too. Anthony Jordan, mm-hmm. They have an all-black behavioral health staff.
Mm-hmm.
All of their mental health counselors is black. They got Sankofa Family Counseling, mm-hmm. Predominantly black therapists over there, too. So it's changing a little bit, especially in Rochester, New York. But it's work to do, though.
It has to, because the work I'm doing now, I work at the Juvenile Detention Center. And I would say that 100% of our kids have faced some type of trauma. 100% of them. A lot of these kids are kids that the system has failed. We didn't pick up on some stuff, and then they commit serious crimes, and now they're, you know, in a situation. And some of them will be coming home shortly, some of them a little longer, right? But we still need to figure out how to get at the root of that trauma and deal with it.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. That's probably one of the reasons why I started a summer camp, too, in my neighborhood. It's called the Michael A. Powell Youth Summer Camp at Sayo Street. It's a 5-week summer camp for at-risk youth. And we do a lot of teaching life skills to these youth, too. It's essential. I'm trying to incorporate a lot of our staff, too, that volunteer, and our staff, too, they're mental health therapists. Mm-hmm. So it's good to be around the kids, too, to kind of, like, assess and look for some of those symptoms that they might be struggling with.
Now, switching gears a little bit, I want to take the aspect off of us being folks that have gone through some stuff. And what is it that you would tell a listening audience as family members who love people who might be incarcerated that are coming home? What are the things that they should do to be supportive of their loved ones?
I think that, you know, every situation is different,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's also going to be based on the relationship that the person that's incarcerated had with the loved one, too, because they might have did some harm to those relationships, mm-hmm. too. But if you could, I would just say get a person the benefit of the doubt. Let them get a fair chance, because that's one of the things, too, that discourage people when they come home, is that they find that those relationships, they're not intact no more. So I might have been in prison and I was saying, okay, at least I know I got my sister when I come home, or I got my mother still. But then when I come home, I see that it's a little animosity still. So the two people, or the few people that I thought I had, is not the same. So I think that just give the benefit of the doubt. I know my uncle, right? He had did some harm to some relationships, and he did 10 years, but he was in jail, in and out of jail for a long time. But I was one of the ones in the family that gave him a fair chance. And this time around, he's been home for like 6 to 7 years now, never reoffended, and he's doing real good for us. So, but I just gave him that fair chance, you know. And one of the things that made it easy for me to give him that fair chance is because he never did no harm personally to me. Mm-hmm. So I was like, that's unk. I was hearing stories from my aunts and stuff like that, but I was like, nah, to me that's unk. So I'm going to be there for him.
Right. And plus, you went through, you know, being away, mm-hmm. so you have a different, you know, view of it, too,
right.
Because you know what it feels like to come home and maybe have somebody not be, you know, supportive, or, you know, what you thought was an asset to you might have been a liability, too.
Right, so, right. I
mean, that happens. So let me ask you this. The governor passed a law that basically said that If you committed a crime in New York State after 7 years, it could be, you know, wiped out after you're done with parole, probation, and the time. What's your opinion of that?
Me personally, I think it's a start, but I think it should have been, this is just my personal opinion, it should have been a lot sooner. I say around 3 years, you know, 8 years, that's damn,
that's a long time.
That's like a lifetime to something. That's a couple of generations, 8 years. I think that a person can show, not necessarily that they rehabilitated, but they can show that they're on a different path in 3 years, you know. And of course, it depends on the nature of the crime, too. Right. You know, you wouldn't want to see certain individuals that employers can't see their record at all.
Right.
But I like it. I think it's in the right direction. It's one of the changes that I do like. A lot of them that I'd be like, nah, you're going too far. But
I was happy about it. But then when I looked at the length of time as well, I was like, wait, this should be based on a lot of other things. So there should be like a recidivism score or a pattern score.
Right.
So they, if you have a certain level of education, like you went out and, you know, got yourself a degree and then got a master's and then, you know, got all these certifications.
I should have had to wait 8 years.
Right.
Right.
So for me, like education, age, the type of crime, all those
how
things.
How many felonies you got? If you got one felony, you should be able to get it sooner than if you had three.
Absolutely. If you're, you know, a repeat offender, of course it should be a longer time versus somebody that only had one.
But what contributes to that is that when these decisions is being made, it's not people like us at the table that can offer this kind of feedback.
Yes, and I think we know from going through it, the types of individuals that are really on the path to changing it around, and then the ones that are just, you know, just existing and may not be willing to even, you know, turn.
They might not be there.
Yeah. So it's funny because I have a way of getting in the room only because of my experience or getting people to hear, you know, my opinion about it. But you're right, we need more people at the table that are actually going through this to say, hey, let me help you write this policy so that it makes sense to the people that it's impacted by.
Right.
So for me, I'm 52, so I gotta wait 8 years. I gotta wait till I'm 60. So you get what I'm saying? It doesn't make a lot of sense in that aspect. I'm happy that they passed something. But the thing I know about governance and government is once they deal with something, they think they've solved the problem. They'll never go back and re-look at the issue and say, hey, we got this wrong. And another problem I have is to raise the age. There's a lot of issues around that because I think they should take into consideration the type of crime, right? Mm-hmm. I think that that they have to talk about. I don't think bail reform is the issue like everybody else, because I think there needed to be something done on that, because we were holding people just for no reason and making the bail so high and they could never get out. And a lot of folks didn't deserve that type of treatment.
Then they started pleading guilty just to get out. Yeah,
right, just to get out. So we were giving people sentences that might have even been innocent, but they wanted to get out, and so they pled to something so they can get out of jail. So there had to be some reform there. But the real issue to me is raise the age, because what we've done is given like all of these chances to people that probably, if you looked at their situation, probably don't deserve those types of chances. They have to have something to rehabilitate them. They can't just get the, you know, you get to use your YO status on a gun. And then they come back on another gun charge. So it's stuff like that where I'm saying, who's at the table talking about this stuff? Because it doesn't make a lot of sense to me in the work that I'm doing now and experiencing, you know, coming home and trying to, you know, come back into the community.
Yeah, for sure. So I agree with you on both of those points. And one of the things about me is that I'm a social worker.
Mm-hmm.
So when I be looking at policies and I be looking at changes that's being made, I'm always paying attention to the unintended consequences.
Yes.
So you passing this law, right? You saying that a person that got murdered can go to a juvenile detention center. Like, I've been to Westfall Road. I know it's nothing like jail, and it's children that
probably. Well, it's not Westfall Road anymore. It's on Rush.
It's Rush. Yeah. It's not Westfall Road.
Westfall is the annex now. That's like
so it's what's Tryon? You ever heard of Tryon?
No, I never heard of Tryon. But Westfall, but it's out Rush. But Westfall is considered the annex campus. The kids that are there are not violent.
Okay. When I was growing up, you was going to Westfall.
Yes, absolutely.
But
yes.
At 16 and 17, you was going downtown. Yep. You was going to jail. Yep. And I just think that if you got like a murder charge or shooting or you got a gun, that's showing that your mentality is not adolescent mentality, right? You shouldn't be around a kid that stole a backpack or you know what I'm saying, got caught with a knife at school and like, they're in detention. I think it's a little different.
It's very different. And I got kids that have graduated high school. They're sitting in the detention center on serious charges. If you can graduate high school, to me, you could be in an adult facility. And I don't mean to sound so brazen about it, but I think you have to look at these cases and say, okay, what makes sense? I understand that a youth's mind doesn't develop fully to 25. Mm-hmm. I get that. But some particular crimes call for you to look at them differently than a kid that stole a kid. Because what got the attention was the Kia boys.
Mm-hmm.
For us that work in the facility, they're the joke. They go to the facility and become gang members.
Mm-hmm.
And they become violent people after being a Kia boy.
Just to fit in, yeah.
But the Kia boys, to people who are at the facility that are really about that life, they're a joke. Mm-hmm. Most people don't know that because the Kia boys was like the hot topic the last year because people getting their cars stolen.
Right, right.
And people thought they were the wildest ones. I was sitting there saying, we probably got about 30 kids that committed serious physical harm to people or killed them.
And what happens too is that some of these laws shield them from seeing how serious it is,
yes.
Right? So you running around, you probably don't touch a juvenile detention center until you done stole, like got caught stealing like four or five cars. But they keep on letting you out and letting you out.
Depends on what court you go to and what town.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so
there are some towns, you're definitely coming to us first time.
Oh, for real? Oh, yeah.
Depending on where you get caught, depending on which judge it is.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I don't want to say anybody's name, but being in it now.
You see.
I know.
Right. Yeah.
Some people are a little more liberal than others. Some people don't play. They look like, I don't. Gotta go.
And that was one of my things, one of my concerns with bail reform. I definitely think it was needed. One time I had a misdemeanor and I sat in jail for like 45 days.
Yeah, that's crazy.
I was a teenager and I couldn't afford the $250 bail.
Yeah.
So I understand. But if you commit a crime, right? Say you broke into a business. And you
what would say allegedly?
You allegedly committed a crime. You broke into a business. You get an appearance ticket. Mm-hmm. I think that's fine. But I just think that you shouldn't get no more appearance tickets while you're already out on one.
Yes.
You know, I think that's when it should change. But you can't keep getting appearance ticket after appearance ticket. That's the only part that I think they should have looked at a little differently.
Yeah, and I'll tell you this: we have some kids that will have them for a period of time. They'll sit with us. They'll use their YO status. They'll get out and then reoffend, and they're back sitting with us again. Like they don't. Like it's funny because I tell them when I see them again, you must really like the food or like me telling you when to go to the bathroom or something because I don't understand why you keep coming back because you can't move unless I give you permission to move. You can't even stand up unless I give you permission to stand up.
And let me tell you this too because my beliefs it's not judgmental,
mm-hmm.
right? I done been there before. I know how it is. When I was 14, 15, no, excuse me, when I was 15, 16, 17, I was in and out.
Mm-hmm.
Right, I know some deputies looking at me at 16 and 17 too. Like you must like it here too. I was coming and getting the TV cell and doing all that. But what I think the system failed is that's the indicator that something not right.
Right.
If you got a child
Absolutely.
That's continuously coming back to you, man, it's not normal. My 14-year-old son, I know where he at all times. He probably laying down playing the game right now in his room. If you have a child that's out committing crimes at 14, 15, 16 years old. That person needs some type of help.
The funny thing is, a parent, I've never been concerned with my children on that aspect because I know how they were raised.
Right.
The only time I had fear for one of my children, my youngest daughter, was during all of the protests here during the Black Lives Matter because she was raised by an activist dad, and this was her time, and she was 14, 15, like going out and protesting. I'm like, yo. Mm-hmm. I didn't want this life for you. This is my. I didn't want this life for her. It was my life. And she was like, Dad, what did you expect?
Mm.
and she stood on it, and I couldn't interfere with that. But was I concerned? Absolutely. As a dad, absolutely. Because I'm sitting there going, if something happened to my baby, I'm gonna lose it.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But she was really into it, and there was a picture of her in the Democratic Chronicle with a bullhorn. I was like, oh my God, a 15-year-old baby, you know, doing this, you know. Right. So, but I never had a concern about them going into the system the way that I see the kids, because I just know what I put into them.
Uh-huh.
But I have a concern for the amount of kids who parents aren't providing the necessary tools for their kids so that they can decipher between right and wrong, mm-hmm. good influences, bad influence. Because a lot of kids we get are followers. They're not leaders. They're following other kids mm-hmm. and doing things. So, you know, I don't know what we could do about that, because I just, my heart kind of aches over it, because I don't, it's such a big, massive problem. Yeah. And I don't think that Rochester's prepared for what will happen if we don't figure out how to deal with it. Because it's bigger than we could ever imagine.
I said not too long ago that based on the crime, and I don't like to call them killboys, but the car thefts and stuff mm-hmm. like that, it looked harmless. It's like it used to be joyriding mm-hmm. When we was a kid. But what people don't understand is that that's the start of the criminal mentality. With the hoodie, you got yep. to sneak up to the car, bust the window. After the excitement of stealing cars is gone, you got that mentality. 9 times out of 10, because I didn't start off as a shooter. I didn't start off like that. It was other little crimes at 15, 16. I was in the streets. Then I started selling drugs. It led to me having that mentality that ultimately sent me to prison. That's the same way with these kids. And I
Absolutely.
Think 4 or 5 years from now, we're going to see high shootings, high homicides, and it's going to be a result of, if it's not adequately addressed, I don't think it's too late to address it.
It's not, but we definitely need to do something quick. Because we don't have a lot of time. When I tell you, I was chair of public safety for the city for over a decade.
Mm.
And I come from a gang background. So what I'm seeing today is not familiar even to me.
Mm.
Being in a gang as a kid, being in public safety for 10 years, and now working at a detention center, I don't recognize this.
Right.
This is different. And if people don't hear that or recognize that or downplay that, we're in trouble.
And those are unintended consequences.
Yep.
What people say, I've been there. When I was in prison, they used to say that I wasn't. A lot of the people that I was locked up with used to say that I wasn't arrested. I was rescued. And what they basically trying to say is that incarceration wasn't a bad thing for me, because if I didn't get incarcerated, 9 times out of 10, I was going to kill somebody or I was going to get killed out there. So when you're making these laws and you're trying to help people not feel the consequences of their action, a lot of the times that's more detrimental to them than anything. Because if a person say, if every time you do something, you got to get bailed out, you got to do consequences, at 9 times out of 10, you ain't going to want to go through that no more. But if you keep getting appearance tickets every time you do something, it's going to take a little bit longer. And then by the time that longer take, you done did something serious you can't get yourself out of.
Right now, we probably at max can handle a little under 50 kids, right? We're building a bigger facility where we're going to be able to hold almost 100 to 110. So think about that. And that's a revolving door.
Wow.
So it's for me, if Rochester needs to hear anything, is that we need to get our arms around all of these children and deal with that, what's at the root of the trauma that they face
mm-hmm.
so that they're not ending up in these predicaments. Because I got some, when I tell you, I work on a unit that has 9 kids. 7 of them got homicides.
I believe it.
So that should tell you something, right? And I got a couple kids, one kid that's got multiple.
Mm. Yeah. So as a social worker, I look at these conversations, and it's a complex thing. You know, mm-hmm. it's people that's I know way more brilliant than me that was trying to figure this thing out in the 80s, in the 90s. 2000s, you had people that's been, some of our ancestors been been trying to tackle some of these things, same things that got us to where we at today. I just think that sometimes the decision makers, they making decisions, but they ain't really.
Well, I would say this, not the just the decisions, it's got to be resources that come with the decisions that go in the right places.
That's strategic, though. If I'm making this change or if I'm doing this, I'm trying to implement this, it got to be some type of specific desire outcome that's measurable. Like Howard Eagle always say, can I smell it? Can I touch it? Can I see it? You know, it got to be that type of. You can't just change a law or do something and then say, okay, I did this. But there's no way to measure if that was good, because if you had a way to measure it, you can always go back and say, we need to move this around a little bit because it's not getting that desired outcome.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I want to thank you for joining me this afternoon on the show. This is the 9th edition of the Bounce Back, 9th episode at least. And I appreciate your insight, your background, and the work that you're doing in the community, and hopefully we can work together on some things, because I've been working on prison reform stuff at the federal level with some people around the country that I got to know just from being away. And I know that you've been working on reentry, and so we definitely got some overlap on some things that we can work together on. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me. This discussion was good. I think it's needed. Because there's a lot going on, so I just appreciate being able to come up here.
No problem, brother. No problem at all. Keep up the good work, man.
All right, thank you.